Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Is Daphne, and I am reading the Cape Cod Times for today, Thursday, June the 1st, 2023. We start with the weather. Today, it is a high of 73, clouds are giving way to sun, and tonight, a low of 57, a moonlit sky. Nothing like moonshadow. Tomorrow, Friday, high of 75, low of 57, partly sunny and pleasant. Saturday, high of 59, low of 50, cloudy, showers around, breezy and cooler. Sunday, 59, high, low of 50, cloudy and breezy with a shower or two. And Monday, a high of 65, a low of 54, periods of cloud and sunshine. And for the lottery, mass cash drawn on Wednesday, May the 31st. The numbers are 3, 7, 9, 11, and 14. Again, that's 3, 7, 9, 11, 14. For Powerball, drawn on Wednesday, May the 31st, the numbers are 2, 4, 54, 61, 62, with the Powerball of 14. Again, for Powerball, 2, 4, 54, 61, 62, with the Powerball of 14. For Mega Millions, drawn on Tuesday, May the 30th, the numbers are 13, 16, 40, 64, 68, with the Mega Ball of 21. Again, Mega Millions drawn on Tuesday, May the 30th, the numbers are 13, 16, 40, 64, 68, with the Mega Ball of 21. For the Megabucks Doubler, drawn yesterday, Wednesday the 31st, the numbers are 1, 3, 11, 17, 43, 47, with the Doubler at 8. And again, Megabucks Doubler for May the 31st, 1, 3, 11, 17, 43, and 47, with the Doubler ball at 8. And finally, Lucky for Life, drawn Wednesday, May the 31st. The numbers are 10, 19, 43, 45, 47, with a lucky ball of 11. Again, for Lucky for Life, drawn Wednesday, the 31st, 10, 19, 43, 45, 47 with the lucky ball of 11. And now for the news from the Cape Cod Times on Thursday, June the 1st. We begin with the front page story entitled New Life at the Landing. This is reported by Zane Razak from Hyannis. And there's a picture of the Cape Town Plaza on Route 132. And there's also a picture of the old sign in the grass, actually. And here's the article. Whole Foods Market will be the anchor tenant in the multi-million-dollar revamp of the Cape Town Plaza on Route 132, WS Development of Chestnut Hill announced on Tuesday. Quote, we're very excited that they'll be coming to the site because they're not only going to generate a lot of interest from the public, but we think that this will be a great driver for additional leasing opportunities, close quote, said Amanda Chisholm of the development director for WS Development. She continued, you can see when you integrate a grocer into a site like this, there are also opportunities to again do seating, activate the sidewalks. So this will be a really great opportunity for the property that will help help to drive investment. Close quote. During a public information session, WS Development and Cape Cod Gateway Airport gave a new glimpse into what the two-phase, $45 million redevelopment will look like. The parcel at 790 Yano Road, also known as Route 132, is owned by the airport and leased to WS Development under the Cape Cod Gateway Airport Commission's control. A Whole Foods market is currently located at 990 Yano Road. Directly across from the Cape Cod Mall, the shopping plaza currently features stores and restaurants such as Panera Bread, Ulta Beauty, Old Navy, and the Paper Store. First developed as a retail center in 1968, the property housed a Kmart for 49 years. The Hyannis store of the once mighty retail giant closed in 2021 as the last Kmart in Massachusetts. WS Development acquired the long-term lease of the plaza in 2018 and plans to transform the 26 acres into a, quote, lifestyle destination, The Landing at Hyannis, featuring retailers and restaurants along with outdoor seating. The current lease expires in 2024. Working with architecture firm Jacobs, WS Development sought to blend the character of Hyannis and Cape Cod with a more modern aesthetic, looking to hallmarks of New England architecture, such as black and white accents, white trim, gridded windows and shingles, and white-painted clapboard siding, according to the company. When people approach the development from Yano Road, they'll drive around a narrow entryway surrounded by landscaping. Quote, "We're also focused on connectivity and pedestrian access," said Chisholm, emphasizing connectivity with the airport. Quote, "We are creating a sidewalk that will go across our property as well as a set of stairs, and then we'll work with the town to put in a crosswalk which will go to the existing sidewalk to the Cape Air facility." More trees and landscaping will also be placed along Yano Road to help soften the edge and provide a buffer. "Big and small tweaks will help refresh the plaza," said Chisholm. The existing canopy that hangs over shops and extends over the sidewalk will be removed to try to create more approachable storefronts and give way to wider sidewalks. The asphalt and parking will also be broken up with landscaping and islands. The creation of housing units is not allowed on the property due to Federal Aviation Administration regulations, Katie Service, the airport manager at Cape Cod Gateway Airport, said. Quote, "Typically on a property that is owned by an airport, the FAA will frown against housing," said Service. Quote, "Commercial space, industrial space, retail space, that's more compatible with airport operations. Obviously, we're surrounded by residential dwellings that live around the airport, but to physically place housing on airport property is usually something that the FAA does not want us to go forward with." The Times previously reported that, according to a March 1 business plan available on the Town of Barnstable website, about half of the Kmart space would become Cape Cod Pickleball, a 10-court indoor pickleball complex with a sports bar and restaurant. Quote, "I know that one tenant has engaged with the town, and I understand our leasing rep has talked to them, but I can't really confirm where those negotiations are or whether or not they'll end up on the site," said Chisholm about the potential pickleball courts. Some construction is already underway, as flooring retailer Floor and Decor prepares parts of the old Kmart to fit its needs. The first phase of development will also feature major facade upgrades of the main building at the property, remodeling interior spaces, and significant site improvements, including new lighting, paving, landscaping, and a public green with seating. Quote, "We've recently received our building permit, so we are poised and ready to go," said Chisholm. A notice to proceed has been issued for contracted work, so construction could be imminent on the site, she said. WS Development is also behind about 50 properties in Massachusetts, including Derby Street Shops in Hingham, Wareham Crossing, the shops of Blackstone Valley in Millbury, Legacy Place in Dedham, and the street Chestnut Hill. News from the State House. Senate plan may hold up Pilgrim discharges, reported by Sam Drysdale. After former Governor Charlie Baker struck down a commission to examine the potential negative environmental effects of dumping radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay last fall, the Senate is seeking to revive the commission through their annual budget. Senators voted to add a Senator Susan Moran Amendment 59 to their fiscal year 2024 budget last week. Under the amendment, a commission would be created to study the impacts of the proposed solution to get rid of spent nuclear fuel pool water from the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth. The amendment would also prevent the Department of Environmental Protection from approving permit applications related to the discharge of radioactive waste into state waters until the commission files a report, which could be as late as November 2025. The nuclear power plant went out of service in 2019 and is in the process of being decommissioned by owner Holtec International. Holtec is working with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency to amend the company's wastewater permit to allow the discharge, which is controversial among environmental advocates and lawmakers. Coastal Senators Julian Sir, Bruce Tarr, and Mark Pacheco all signed on to Moran's amendment to create the commission to study the potential environmental and economic impacts of the move. And U.S. Senator Ed Markey is a known advocate against Holtec's plan. Quote, "To have legislation that is now solidified in the Senate to be able to advance this conversation with people from Dukes County, Plymouth County, really everyone who might be affected, whether it's by their own health or they are in the fishing industry or tourism industry, is just really important," Moran said. The commission would include the Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs, Secretary of Health and Human Services, representatives from the House and Senate, the Commissioner of Environmental Protection, Commissioner of Public Health, Executive Director of Travel and Tourism, Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game, and scientific experts appointed by the governor with expertise in marine radiochemistry, physical oceanography, health physics, nuclear chemistry, and chemical oceanography. The commission favored by Moran will be on the table for House-Senate conference committee talks this month over a final budget bill. A similar provision was struck from an economic development bill that Baker signed last fall. Quote, "I am vetoing this section as the commission's work would be duplicative of and would interfere with ongoing work on waste disposal and decommissioning issues by the responsible federal and state agencies," Baker wrote of his veto of the commission. Holtec Director of Government Affairs and Communications, Patrick O'Brien, said Baker, quote, had some good reasons for the veto. Ultimately, radiological discharges are strictly the purview of the federal government and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and right now we're going through a process with the EPA to amend our permit, O'Brien said. Quote, "We anticipate it to take at least a year for that process, in addition to the state one, which we've looked to amend as well. So we're going to let those play out," close quote. Moran said that the commission would have the advantage of participating in listening sessions where they would hear directly from people within Dukes, Plymouth, Bristol, and Barnstable counties about their feelings on the decommissioning plan. Quote, "This amendment literally just puts the brakes on a DEP approval of any permit specifically related to the dumping until the commission completes its report. So in big picture terms, if passed in committee, it will prevent a single drop of nuclear discharge until we can fully understand the environmental and economic impacts that this could have," Moran said. When asked if this commission reporting process would hold up Holtec's plans, O'Brien repeated that radiological discharges are solely under the federal government's purview. Quote, obviously, we're going to work through the EPA in the process they've asked us to do, and that's where we are in the process, he said. Moran said the State Commission, through this examination and public hearing model, could be used as an example for decommissioning of other nuclear plants across the country. Quote, when you look at how this contaminated material is handled all across the country, it sometimes is a matter of corporate greed and looking for the cheapest way to get rid of it, which might be dumping it into Cape Cod Bay. And that's what we want to protect against, Moran said. Quote, Holtec already has the taxpayers' money to be able to do this right in a protected fund for this reason, and we want to be sure that the money is spent on public health and not corporate greed. And for some local news, Bourne Select Board staff to work on cannabis sales bylaw, reported by Paul Gately, Buzzards Bay, special to the Cape Cod Times. Recreational marijuana sales advocates want to cooperate with the Bourne Planning Board and town staff to draft a new zoning bylaw regulating dispensaries. One would pass muster at a town meeting, possibly as soon as this summer. The select board likes the idea. The board, on May 23rd, voted 5-0 to direct Town Administrator Marlene McCollum and Town Planner Jennifer Copeland to work with the Planning Board on a zoning bylaw effort. Board members said that the town's elected Planning Board is favored to work on cannabis zoning efforts instead of a special task force as advanced by a former Select Board member. The 9-member elected planning board decided on May the 25th the collaborative approach was a good idea, promising, quote, an open discussion and fluid review, close quote, of various bylaw possibilities submitted in advance to the town planning office. Quote, we'll try to discuss this in a timely manner, planning board chair Daniel Doucette said. On May the 1st, a citizen petition to allow recreational marijuana sales in the town of Bourne was narrowly defeated at the special and annual town meeting. The 249-248 vote on marijuana sales also recorded one abstention. The tally prompted gasps from all around and groans from the marijuana enthusiasts along with their "We'll be back" pledge. Many quickly departed the auditorium at Bourne High School after the vote. The May the 1st vote represented the fourth attempt to secure approval for commercial marijuana retail stores in Bourne. Edward Dow, a cannabis businessman, said Bourne outlets would present no danger to children, and Stephen Stroyney of Monument Beach urged residents to, quote, vote the facts, not the scare tactics, close quote. There are 15 recreational marijuana establishments on the Cape and Islands that are authorized to sell to the public as of late April, according to the Cannabis Control Commission. 7 Cape towns have banned shops from operating within their borders. Massachusetts voters passed a ballot initiative in November of 2016 legalizing adult-use marijuana in the state. For now, the Bourne ban on recreational pot sales remains in effect. Bert Stroyney, a former planning board member, said proponents will return. The idea is to create a new palatable bylaw that is equitable for marijuana business proponents and weed opponents alike, as well as protecting the town's best interests and affording a reasonable business climate, he said. This, he said, can be done through the elected planning board. If it does not work out, a private petition article could also be filed again to repeal the Bourne dispensaries ban, along with another article to advance a bylaw replacement crafted by the marijuana business supporters. Stroyney, however, said this need not occur. He suggests Bourne dispensaries could eventually fulfill customer demand and fill town coffers. Quote, we've met with the plan manager and the town planner, he told the select board on May the 23rd. Nothing is etched in stone now. The repeal of the ban is coming, perhaps not next month, but it is coming. Close quote. Newly elected select board chair Mary Jane Mastrangelo, said the town must prepare for any sudden meeting with the recreational marijuana sales again on the warrant via a private petition article. If that happens, a stronger transponder bylaw is needed. Mastrangelo said, if that happened, a stronger town-sponsored bylaw is needed, Mastrangelo said. A new marijuana control bylaw effort remains a planning board function, said select board member Melissa Ferretti. Quote, it can't be unreasonable or impractical, she said. We want a climate in which business can succeed, close quote. Mastrangelo said a new bylaw should include a special permit provision to ensure the community, quote, that appropriate locations are set for any dispensary, close quote. She said such sites from Carver and Wareham to Mashpee are controlled by special permit provisions. Stroyney, however, favors the creation of a town zoning overlay map that would delineate areas exactly where pot dispensaries could be set up. Planning board member Christopher Farrell told the select board his committee is authorized to create zoning bylaws and that the process would be public and televised. A special task force on marijuana, he suggested, could lead, quote, to the possibility of things going on behind the scenes, close quote. Stroyney told the planning board that retail recreational cannabis dispensaries, quote, will create a cash flow in the millions of dollars for the town as the years roll along, close quote. He said downtown Buzzards Bay, MacArthur Boulevard, also known as Route 28, and a section of Sagamore would seem suitable for dispensaries. Planning board members, meanwhile, said any bylaw prepared for town meeting review should not be crafted to the extent that visual appeal outweighs technical aspects of dispensary review during the special permitting process. And on top of a wonderful picture of strawberries growing and getting ripe and red is a title, A Berry Good Time. And it says, strawberry season has arrived at Tony Andrews' farm in Falmouth as farmer Jeff Andrews surveys his crop on Wednesday. The dry days have made for a good crop this year, Andrews said. The farm will have a soft opening on Saturday from 10 a.m. until all are picked, weathering permitted. The season opens daily starting June the 9th. From national news, ethics questions vex high court justices, reported by Mark Sherman of the Associated Press in Washington. One Supreme Court justice explained her absence from a case. One justice didn't. The difference shows how difficult forging consensus over even small steps on ethics can be at the Supreme Court, which is facing new calls to adopt an ethics code following revelations about undisclosed gifts from a Republican megadonor to Justice Clarence Thomas. Last week, Chief Justice John Roberts acknowledged the court needs to do more to reassure a skeptical public that the justices take their ethical obligations seriously. Though the justices have been resistant to a binding code of ethical standards, all nine signed a statement on ethics principles and practices issued in late April that promised at least some small additional disclosure when one or more among them opts not to take part in a case. A justice, quote, may provide a summary explanation of a recusal decision, the statement reads, a change from the standard practice of saying nothing at all. A week ago, Justice Elena Kagan became the first member of the court to explain herself, indicating that her previous employment in the President Barack Obama's administration kept her out of an appeal, rejected by the court, from a death row inmate in Florida. But on Tuesday, when the court turned away an appeal from energy companies, Justice Samuel Alito said nothing about why he was not involved. Alito did not immediately respond to a request from the Associated Press for comment sent through the court's Public Information Office. The probable reason for Alito's decision is not hard to find in his last financial disclosure report. He owns between $15,000 and $50,000 in stock in Phillips 66, one of the companies that appealed. Criticism of the court stems principally from a series of reports by the nonprofit investigative journalism organization ProPublica about undisclosed gifts, including payment of a relative's school tuition and luxury trips provided to Thomas by Harland Crow, a Dallas billionaire. And some weather-related news. Many of us have friends in Connecticut who are reporting that it is very smoky outside, and here is a report on why and how this has happened. A wildfire in Nova Scotia, which forces 16,000 to evacuate in Halifax. Nova Scotia's leader begged people to stay out of the woods and avoid any activity that could start more fires after a wildfire on Canada's Atlantic coast damaged about 200 houses and other structures and prompted the evacuation of 16,000 people. Quote, "It's extensive, it's heartbreaking," said Premier Tim Houston, who announced a ban on woodland activity after visiting the disaster area to get a sense of the damage. Many residents were eager to return Tuesday to see whether homes and pets had survived, while fire officials expressed concern that windy, dry conditions could cause a reburn in the evacuated subdivisions. The forecast was calling for hotter weather on Friday and no rain until Friday at the earliest. Houston said the ban extends to all travel and activity in all wooded areas. That includes all forestry, mining, hunting, fishing, hiking, camping, off-road vehicle driving, and all commercial activity on government lands, he said. Quote, "Don't be burning right now. No burning in Nova Scotia. Conservation officers reported 6 illegal burns last night. This is absolutely ridiculous with what is happening in this province. 3 out-of-control fires, 8 fires yesterday, 12 on Sunday. Do not burn," Houston said Tuesday. Quote, "We have to do what we can to make sure we don't have new fires popping up." Scott Tingley, the forest protection manager in the province's wildfire management group, said it's safe to say that all of these fires were, quote, "very likely human-caused. Much of it is probably preventable," Tingley said. Firefighters have been working to extinguish hot spots in the fire that started in the Halifax area on Sunday, Halifax Deputy Fire Chief David Meldrum said. He said Tuesday that it was too early to give an exact count of homes damaged or destroyed, but the municipal government put the total at about 200 buildings. And from World News, new warning suggests AI raises risk of extinction. This is an API report from London. Scientists and tech industry leaders, including high-level executives at Microsoft and Google, issued a new warning Tuesday about the perils that artificial intelligence poses to humankind. Quote, "Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war," the statement said. Sam Altman, CEO of ChatGPT maker OpenAI, and Geoffrey Hinton, a computer scientist known as the godfather of artificial intelligence, were among the hundreds of leading figures who signed the statement, which was posted on the Center for AI Safety's website. Worries about artificial intelligence systems outsmarting humans and running wild have intensified with the rise of a new generation of highly capable AI chatbots known as ChatGPT. It has sent countries around the world scrambling to come up with regulations for the developing technology, along with the European Union blazing the trail with its AI Act expected to be approved later this year. The latest warning was intentionally succinct, just a single sentence to encompass a broad coalition of scientists who might not agree on the most likely risks or the best solutions to prevent them, said Dan Hendricks, executive director of the San Francisco-based nonprofit Center for AI Safety, which organized the move. There's a variety of people from all top universities in various different fields who are concerned by this and think that this is a global priority, Hendricks said. So we had to get people to sort of come out of the closet, so to speak, on this issue, because many were sort of silently speaking among each other. More than 1,000 researchers and technologists, including Elon Musk, had signed a much longer letter earlier this year calling for a 6-month pause on AI development, saying it poses profound risks to society and humanity. That letter was a response to OpenAI's release of a new AI model, GPT-4. But leaders at OpenAI, its partner Microsoft and rival Google, didn't sign on and rejected the call for a voluntary industry pause. By contrast, the latest statement was endorsed by Microsoft's chief technology and science officers, as well as Demis Hassabis, CEO of Google's AI research lab, DeepMind, and two Google executives who lead its AI policy efforts. Some critics have complained that dire warnings about existential risks voiced by makers of AI have contributed to hyping up the capabilities of their products and distracting from calls for more immediate regulations to rein in their real-world problems. Hendricks said, "There's no reason why society can't manage the urgent, ongoing harms of products that generate new texts or images, while also starting to address the potential catastrophes around the corner." He compared it to nuclear scientists in the 1930s warning people to be careful, even though we haven't quite developed the bomb yet. Nobody is saying that GPT-4 or ChatGPT today is causing these sorts of concerns, Hendricks said. We're trying to address these risks before they happen rather than try and address catastrophes after the fact. The letter was also signed by experts in nuclear science, pandemics, and climate change. Among the signatories is the writer Bill McKibben, who sounded the alarm on global warming in his 1989 book, The End of Nature, and warned about AI and companion technologies 2 decades ago in another book. Given our failure to heed the early warnings about climate change 35 years ago, it feels to me as if it would be smart to actually think this one through before it's all a done deal, he said by email on Tuesday. We're at about our halfway point, and so it's time to share obituaries. There are 3 in today's paper. Andrew Francis Picariello from Marston Mills. Quote, "If someone calls and they need you, you go." That phrase sums up Andrew Picariello's philosophy and life spent in service to his families, friends, colleagues, community church, and the International Vintage Racing Car Fraternity. Andy was always the first with his hand up to help, be it rescuing baby birds and stray dogs in childhood, serving as an altar boy and Boy Scout, wingman to a disabled friend throughout their school years, or holding leadership roles across his career and in numerous community service and club roles. Born in the Great Depression, Andy was the youngest of 3 children and the only boy of first-generation Italian immigrants Mario, Mike Picariello, and Flora DeFazio. He often recalled the secure base his extended family had forged at their Carter Street farm in Newton Upper Falls, Massachusetts. There was enough to eat, cousins to play with, and family security anchored by strong women. This instilled Andy's unshakable belief that through faith, hard work, frugality, resilience, and loyalty, in striving to do the right thing by yourself and others, you would succeed. Apprenticing with his plumber father nurtured Andy's intrinsic fascination with how things work, chemistry, and speed. By age 5, he was zipping around in his homemade pedal car, and his school years spawned all manner of useful and curious apparatus, invariably involving vehicles, photography, or combustion. Though Andy's interests were more practical than academic, there was never a question that he was university-bound, and he earned a pre-med degree from Boston College in 1956. Andy prized the Catholic intellectual tradition often lamenting the bygone era when a working-class Italian kid could get a Jesuit education on the proceeds of a summer job. Andy began his professional life in laboratory testing before quickly deducing that selling scientific equipment to laboratories would be more lucrative than working in one. A born storyteller and humorist, Andy's diligence and natural ease with people of all walks of life facilitated rapid career progression. Howe & French and Health Company in Boston, then more than 20 years with Corning Industries medical and scientific business, where as senior sales rep for the New England Laboratory Equipment Division, he won the prestigious President's Circle Award for Sales Excellence, an unprecedented 2 times. Andy's brief stint in the lab, however, did afford the encounter with his future wife, Judith Margaret Merrill, an RN working with a gynecologist in the same building. Upon marrying in 1963, they settled in Needham, home to Andy's family, where their first daughter, Margaret, was born a year later, followed by Mimi in 1956. Throughout the early years of their marriage, Andy worked daytime in sales and nights in his home basement workshop repairing lab equipment, while Judy supervised the overnight nursing staff at Glover Memorial Hospital's emergency room. This very contemporary arrangement was made possible by living above Andy's parents, who looked after Margaret while Andy and Judy worked around the clock until Mimi's arrival. Judy went back to work as a school nurse once Mimi was in school full-time, and she later returned to surgical nursing for the final 20 years of her career. A staunch advocate for women's education and advancement, Andy was immensely proud of how Judy managed family, career, and social life, and his daughters, Margaret, attended Mount Holyoke Wesley and went on to earn master's and Ph.D. degrees, respectively. He sponsored the Needham Exchange Club's first female member and over the decades mentored many female trainee sales reps embarking on their Corning careers. Andy often remarked that heading the sales trainee program, his final with Corning, was his most satisfying and enjoyable. Andy and Judy loved their extended family, friends, and community and embedded themselves in Needham's fabric. Andy joined the Exchange Club in 1965, served as club president 1978 to 79, and was named Exchangeite Extraordinaire a decade later. Upon, quote, retiring to Marsden Mills on Cape Cod in 1994, Andy joined the Osterville Men's Club, the West Barnstable Deer Club, and revived the Old Post Landing Neighborhood Association, serving as president and treasurer for many years. Post-corporate life also shifted Andy's lifelong passion for vintage British racing cars to high gear. He was acknowledged worldwide for his expertise in his favorite marquee, Allard's, serving as secretary of the U.S. Allard Owners Club for decades. Thousands of painstaking hours spent exquisitely restoring his 1950 J2 Allard Competition Roadster and 1950 K2 Allard rendered them both the best in the world, and the cars won prestigious national and international awards. Enjoying the social aspects as much as the cars themselves, car club events took Andy and Judy all over the U.S. and globe, often to the U.K. as far as New Zealand. Andy drove to heaven to join Judy on May 17th after a brief illness. In lieu of flowers, please consider donating in Andy's memory to the Cape Cod MSPCA or the Collie Rescue League of New England. Our second obituary from Mashpee, Lorraine Louise Ribello Burtis. Lorraine Louise Ribello Burtis of Mashpee passed away on May 25, 2023, with her loving family by her side. Born in Wareham on June 10, 1951, to the late Marie Ribello of Falmouth and her grandmother, Mary Ribello, two women that made a huge impact on her younger life. She was a graduate of Lawrence High, class of 1969. Lorraine leaves behind her beloved husband of 52 years, Jonathan Burtis, her loving daughter, Jennifer Zielinski, her two treasured grandsons, Brock and Mason Zielinski, all of Mashpee, her cherished cousin, Raymond Eldridge III, and his daughter, Trinity Eldridge. Lorraine had many various employments until her family took over Little River Boatyard on Secaucet Island, Mashpee, where she ran day-to-day operations for numerous years. Lorraine's love for all animals, especially cats, the beach, gardening, music, and football was like none other. She was best known for her infectious smile, contagious laugh, huge heart, and will be missed dearly by many. Lorraine's family would like to extend a heartfelt thank you to Patrizia and Teresa for exceptional care for many years after suffering a stroke in 2004. A funeral mass will take place at St. Anthony's Church, 167 East Falmouth Highway, East Falmouth, on Wednesday, June the 7th, 2023, at 10 a.m. In lieu of flowers, please consider making a donation to People for Cats, P.O. Box 422, West Falmouth, Massachusetts, 02574. And the email address is info@peopleforcats.org. Or to the MSPCA, 1577 Falmouth Road, Centerville, Massachusetts, 02632. And the email address there is careadoptions@mspca.org. These donations in her memory, which would warm her heart immensely. For online guestbook and directions, visit www.chapmanfuneral.com. And finally, this obituary for Susan Cates Cataret from Yarmouth. Susan Cates Cataret, 63, of Yarmouth, formerly of Avon and Brockton, passed away at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center on May the 22nd, 2023. She is survived by her mother, Audrey Capiello Nugent of Yarmouth, her brother, Michael Cates, and wife Lisa of Bradenton, Florida, daughter Michelle Cataret, son Michael Cataret, both of Brockton, former husband Beau Cataret of Holbrook, stepdaughter Christy Gingras and husband Cam, grandsons Yamini and Jace, granddaughter Brielle, nieces and nephews Miles, Ryan, Casey, Cole, and Carly. Sue graduated from Avon High School, class of 1978. She then furthered her education at Brockton Hospital School of Nursing and Curry College, where she earned a nursing degree, RN. As a lifelong nurse and caregiver, she had a natural gift for serving others. Sue welcomed everything and everyone into her life and treated her children's friends as her own, endearingly referred to as Mama Sue or Auntie Sue. Despite Sue and Beau's divorce, they remained best friends throughout their lives, as Sue was Beau's cherub. She was best known for her huge and giving heart. When Sue wasn't caring for her patients, she enjoyed spending time with her cat, Lulu, but her greatest joy of all was being with her grandchildren, whom she adored. Memorial service will be held at Chapman Funerals in Yarmouth on Monday, June the 5th, 2023, from 4 to 6 p.m. National news from the Nation and World Extra part of the Cape Cod Times. House okays bill to avert default. Hard-fought Biden-McCarthy deal heads to the Senate now. And this is reported by Lisa Mascaro, Kevin Freaking, Stephen Groves, and Farnoosh Amari for Associated Press. Veering away from a default crisis, the House approved a debt ceiling and budget cuts package late Wednesday as President Joe Biden and Speaker Kevin McCarthy assembled a bipartisan coalition of centrist Democrats and Republicans against fierce conservative blowback and progressive dissent. The hard-fought deal pleased few, but lawmakers assessed it was better than the alternative, a devastating economic upheaval if Congress failed to act. Tensions ran high throughout the day as hard right Republicans refused the deals, while Republicans said Democrats said extremist GOP views were risking a debt default as soon as next week. With the House vote of 314 to 117, the bill now heads to the Senate, with passage expected by week's end. McCarthy insisted his party was working to give America hope as he launched into a late evening speech extolling the bill's budget cuts, which he said were needed to curb Washington's runaway spending. But amidst discontent from Republicans who said the spending restrictions did not go far enough, McCarthy said it is only a first step. Earlier, Biden expressed optimism that the agreement he negotiated with McCarthy to lift the nation's borrowing limit would pass the chamber and avoid an economically disastrous default on America's debts. The president departed Washington for Colorado, where he is scheduled to deliver the commencement address Thursday at the U.S. Air Force Academy. Quote, God willing, by the time I land, Congress will have acted, the House will have acted, and we'll be one step closer, quote, he said. That wasn't quite the case. The vote began about half an hour after Biden arrived in Colorado. Biden sent top White House officials to the Capitol to shore up backing. McCarthy worked to sell skeptical fellow Republicans, even fending off challenges to his leadership. Swift passage later in the week by the Senate would ensure government checks would continue to go out to Social Security recipients, veterans, and others, and would prevent financial upheaval at home and abroad. Next Monday is when the Treasury has said the U.S. would run short of money to pay its debts. Biden and McCarthy were counting on support from the political center, a rarity in divided Washington, testing the leadership of the Democratic president and the Republican speaker. Overall, the 99-page bill restricts spending for the next 2 years, suspends the debt ceiling into January 2025, and changes some policies, including imposing new work requirements for older Americans receiving food aid and greenlighting an Appalachian natural gas line that many Democrats oppose. It bolsters funds for defense and veterans. Raising the nation's debt limit, now $31 trillion, ensures Treasury can borrow to pay already incurred U.S. debts. Top GOP deal negotiator Representative Garrett Graves of Louisiana said Republicans were fighting for budget cuts after Democrats piled onto deficits with extra spending, first during the COVID-19 crisis and later with Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, with its historic investment to fight climate change. But Republican Representative Chip Roy, a member of the Freedom Caucus helping to lead the opposition, said, quote, my beef is that you cut a deal that shouldn't have been cut, close quote. For weeks, negotiators labored late into the night to strike the deal with the White House, and for days, McCarthy has worked to build support among skeptics. At one point, aides wheeled in pizza at the Capitol the night before the vote as he walked Republicans through the details, fielded questions, and encouraged them not to lose sight of the bill's budget savings. The speaker has faced a tough crowd. Cheered on by conservative senators and outside groups, the hard-right House Freedom Caucus lambasted the compromise as falling well short of the needed spending cuts, and they vowed to try to halt passage. A much larger conservative faction, the Republican Study Committee, declined to take a position. Even rank-and-file centrist conservatives were unsure, leaving McCarthy searching for votes from his slim Republican majority. Ominously, the conservatives warned of a possibility of trying to oust McCarthy over the compromise. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries said it was up to McCarthy to turn out at least 150 Republican votes, two-thirds of the majority, even as he assured reporters that Democrats would supply the rest to prevent a default. In the 435-member House, 218 votes are needed for approval. As the tally faltered in the afternoon procedural vote, Jeffries stood silently and raised his green voting card, signaling that the Democrats would fill in the gap to ensure passage. They did, advancing the bill that 29 hard-right Republicans, many from the Freedom Caucus, refused to back. Quote, "What does it say about this extreme MAGA Republican majority," said Jeffries, Democrat from New York, "about the party aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again political movement?" The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said the spending restrictions in the package would reduce deficits by $1.5 trillion over the decade, a top goal for the Republicans trying to curb the debt load. In a surprise that complicated Republican support, however, the CBO said their drive to impose work requirements on older Americans receiving food stamps would end up boosting spending by $2.1 billion over the time period. That's because the final deal exempts veterans and homeless people, expanding the food stamp rolls by 78,000 people monthly, the CBO said. Liberal discontent, though, ran strong as Democrats also broke away, decrying the new work requirement for older Americans, those 50 to 54, in the food aid program. Some Democrats were also incensed that the White House negotiated into the deal changes in the landmark National Environmental Policy Act and approval of the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline natural gas project. The energy development is important to Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, but many others oppose it as unhelpful in fighting climate change. Senators who have remained largely on the sidelines during much of the negotiations are insisting on amendments to reshape the package, but making any changes at this stage seems unlikely with so little time to spare. And at the end of this article are pictures of Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer with the caption, "In the Senate, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell left and Democratic majority leader Chuck Schumer are working for passage by week's end." And finally, actor Masterson convicted of 2 counts of rape in retrial. That 70s show's star faces 30 years to life, reported by Andrew Dalton of the Associated Press from Los Angeles. That 70s show star, Danny Masterson, was led out in handcuffs from a Los Angeles courtroom Wednesday and could get 30 years to life in prison after a jury found him guilty on 2 of 3 counts of rape at its second trial, in which the Church of Scientology played a central role. Masterson's wife, actor and model Bijou Phillips, gasped when the verdict was read and wept as he was taken into custody, while a group of family and friends who sat stone-faced behind him throughout the trials. The jury of 7 women and 5 men reached the verdict after deliberating for 7 days spread over 2 weeks. They could not reach a verdict on the 3rd count that alleged Masterson raped a longtime girlfriend. They had voted 8-4 in favor of conviction. Masterson, 47, will be held without bail until he is sentenced. No sentencing date has been set, but the judge told Masterson and his lawyers to return to court August the 4th for a hearing. Quote, "I'm experiencing a complex array of emotions, relief, exhaustion, strength, sadness, knowing that my abuser, Danny Masterson, will face accountability for his criminal behavior," one of the women, whom Masterson knew as a fellow member of the church and was convicted of raping at his home in 2003, said in a statement. A second woman, a former girlfriend, whose count left the jury deadlocked, said in a statement, "While I'm encouraged that Danny Masterson will face some criminal punishment, I am devastated that he has dodged criminal accountability for his heinous conduct against me." A spokesperson for Masterson declined comment, but his attorneys will almost certainly appeal. After a deadlocked jury led to a mistrial in December, prosecutors retried Masterson, saying he forcibly raped three women in his Hollywood Hills home between 2001 and 2003. They told jurors he drugged the women's drinks so he could rape them. They said he used his prominence in the church, where all three women were also members at the time, to avoid consequences for decades. We want to express our gratitude to the three women who came forward and bravely shared their experiences, Los Angeles County District Attorney George Gascon said after the verdict. Masterson did not testify, and his lawyers called no witnesses. The defense argued that the acts were consensual and attempted to discredit the women's stories by highlighting changes and inconsistencies over time, which they said showed signs of coordination between them. Quote, "If you decide that a witness deliberately lied about something in this case," defense attorney Philip Cohen told jurors, going through their instructions in his closing argument, quote, "you should consider not believing anything the witness says," close quote. The Church of Scientology played a significant role in the first trial, but arguably an even larger one in the second. Judge Charlene F. Almeida allowed expert testimony on church policy from a former official in Scientology leadership who has become a prominent opponent. Tensions ran high in the courtroom between current and former Scientologists and even leaked into testimony, with the accuser saying on the stand that they felt intimidated by some members in the room. Actor Leah Remini, a former member who has become the church's highest-profile critic, sat in on the trial at times, putting her arm around one of the accusers to comfort her at one point. Remini said on Twitter that the two guilty verdicts in the retrial are a relief. Quote, "The women who survived Danny Masterson's predation are heroes. For years, they and their families have faced vicious attacks and harassment from Simon Scientology and Danny's well-funded legal team," she posted. "Nevertheless, they soldiered on, determined to seek justice." The alleged harassment, which the church denies engaging in, is the subject of a civil lawsuit filed by two of the accusers. Founded in 1953 by L. Ron Hubbard, the Church of Scientology has many members who work in Hollywood. The judge kept limits on how much prosecutors could talk about the church, and primarily allowed it to explain why the women took so long to go to authorities. The women testified that when they reported Masterson to church officials, they were told they were not raped, were put through ethics programs themselves, and were warned against going to law enforcement to report a member of such high standing. Quote, "They were raped, they were punished for it, and they were retaliated against," Deputy District Attorney Reinhold Mueller told jurors in his closing argument. "Scientology told them there's no justice for them," close quote. The church vehemently denied having any policy that forbids members from going to secular authorities. Next week, the judge who oversaw the criminal case will hold a hearing to determine how a lawyer who represents the Church of Scientology had evidence that the prosecution shared with the defense. The evidence involved links that the lawyer accidentally included in an email to Mueller. The two women whose testimony led to Masterson's conviction said that in 2003 he gave them drinks and that they then became woozy or passed out before he violently raped them. He knew both from social circles in the church. The third, Masterson's then-girlfriend of 5 years, whose count left the jury deadlocked, said she awoke to find him raping her and had to pull his hair to stop him. The issue of drugging also played a major role in the retrial. At the first, Almeida only allowed prosecutors and accusers to describe why they were drugged. The second time, they were allowed to argue it directly, and the prosecution attempted to make it a major factor to no avail. Masterson was not charged with any counts of drugging, and there is no toxicology evidence to back up any assertions. So that's the news for Thursday, June the 1st. From the Cape Cod Times, this is Daphne, and I hope and wish for all of us that this is a beautiful day and that it is a harbinger for a wonderful summer.